You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast's interview with Abram Lustgarten, Emmy and Pulitzer Prize-nominated climate journalist at ProPublica. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
So New York will ultimately build a seawall that it estimates now will cost somewhere in the order of $120 billion. And the fact is that many cities in the United States will not be able to afford that, especially smaller ones and especially southern ones. And so a part of planning for this needs to include thinking about managed retreat from highly vulnerable areas, the tax base of that community that supports schools. It undermines the real estate market and the value of property, and it can lead to a spiral of economic decline that can be really dangerous for the people who remain and that could really hollow out a community. And that's an enormous challenge to deal with. But one way to deal with it is to try to keep the resources and infrastructure in a community proportional to the population that's utilizing it and to maintain some energy and prosperity and vitality. So I think a lot of places in the United States need to plan to get smaller, which is really the antithesis of, you know, of the American philosophy of growth and economic growth. And if you want to keep your community intact, you could move together, or you could move to a place where you know that your neighbors have also moved or something like that. And that's the kind of new idea that is being batted around that can help keep communities coherent. This is a passage about a woman named Colette Pichon Battle, who's one of the people that I write about, who is trying to deal with how climate change changes where she lives. And after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans in 2005, she moves home to the Louisiana coast, and she moves home to try to protect her community and help it rebuild and to basically resist the tides of potential climate migration. And so this is just a little bit about Colette and her experience there. As tens of thousands of people continued to leave the wreckage of Louisiana in the weeks and months following the storm, and Mary remained a refugee, that's her mother, Colette moved back home. 15 generations on the bayou, a legacy in jeopardy, exerted a gravitational pull she could not resist. The devastation spoke to her. The rebuilding beckoned. She thought about the survivors. "There are these trees here," she says, describing the deeply rooted, majestic oaks that dot the landscape of southern Louisiana and the Mississippi coast. The tidal surge snapped the pines like pixie sticks. The briny ocean water turned grasses brown and dead, killing animals and fish both, along with flowers and shrubs. "Not everything made it," she said, "but these trees, these oaks, they made it, and they stood." Colette knew that her home might never be rebuilt. She knew her mother might never come back. But she tells the story, grasping for an explanation for why she herself returned, trying to find words that could describe the role she felt suddenly compelled to fulfill. "And I feel more like that, right?" she says, comparing herself to the aged oaks. "I feel like that. I'm watching other trees go down. I'm watching changes, but I've got the roots that are strong enough to hold." And so Colette became the resistance, pushing back against all the forces arrayed against her, the storm after the storm. She thought at the time she'd join a great healing, the rebuilding that would bring her mother home and the restoration of all the ties that gave life their meaning. She would bring the whole bayou home. She began to talk about the risks in terms that the bayou community around her could not recognize. She warned that if they failed to rebuild, to be resilient, the only option would be to migrate away from Louisiana's southern coast. That while the recovery from the storm looked bleak, the alternative could be far worse. "People thought we were crazy," she says, "but that's how it begins." When I began to write this book, I thought that by the time I finished it, I would have moved somewhere and it would provide a great narrative arc for the text. And I would finish the book describing my wonderful experience on my new farm in Vermont or something like that. Obviously, that hasn't happened for me yet. I haven't moved. I love where I live. I remain for the moment, but I accept that that may change. That's not a permanent decision. And there's others that I talk to and that I write about in the book who also muse about the possibility of a more nomadic future, that maybe home isn't a permanent place with deep roots, but is a transient place with shallow roots, or two places that you alternate between, or things like that. And I think that in addition to a lot of other dramatic changes that the book is about, a change in our sense of home and our sense of place is a part of this story. A lot of the conversation around climate migration is about where people will go, but also half of the conversation is about where people will leave from. and what happens to those communities. Adapting to these changes requires both. And when you drill down and get really into the, you know, the nuts and bolts of it, a lot of the conversation is about urban planning and sustainability planning and what that means for cities. And I think losing the use of land in certain parts of the country is an inevitable part of that process. And mainly because water is increasingly scarce, especially in the American Southwest. Right now, we're in a really difficult political process of basically reapportioning, you know, that water and deciding how it should be allocated. And should more of it go to cities? Can it be saved if it doesn't go to farms? And you can break down then how those farms use that water. There's a lot of like incremental decisions that can extend the availability of resources like water for a long time into the future. And so I think if carefully managed and some painful compromises are agreed upon, lands in really hard hit parts of the United States can remain viable and usable for a long time. And if you want to keep your community intact, it's just difficult. But one of the ways that I've personally begun to think about climate migration as I reflect on how it's affected me is the loss of a certain kind of freedom. This only partially addresses your question, but the loss of a certain kind of freedom to choose where I want to live whimsically or based on subjective values like how beautiful it is or how inviting it seems, things like that. And that freedom will be replaced with a more pragmatic necessity to live in a place because it is safe or because it is viable or you can grow food. So that in terms of, you know, manifest destiny attitude, it reflects a loss of a certain kind of privilege and flexibility. And that's from one perspective of what, you know, manifest destiny is about. The other is about maybe the darker side of that manifest destiny, right? The displacement of so many people, of Native people in the United States, and of just this sort of cultural assumption that white Americans primarily get to choose wherever they want to be and go there and take that place for themselves. So for me, there's no clear trends here, except that a lot of my reporting on this issue has focused on how incredibly inequitable the impacts of climate change are. Other climate related negotiations get increasingly, you know, protracted and bogged down. I think the conversation about global migration does as well for a number of reasons. It very quickly gets to questions about responsibility and loss and damage. And the United States is proportionately largely responsible for the changes in our global environment for warming. So the question is, you know, should the United States and other Western nations that have emitted large amounts of carbon also be responsible disproportionately for facilitating that migration that the United Nations projects? Or do we just, you know, resist that and push it off and defend against it? And countries at the negotiation table don't want that direct responsibility. They don't want it to be defined in concrete terms because it becomes a liability and nobody's sure how to proceed. And my belief from conversations that I've had with people in or close to the administration is that they understand this era of mass movement of people, much the same way that I do. And they've articulated their versions of its significance to me and the need for action, the need for foreign aid, the challenges at borders, the need for empathy and to support, you know, people around the world. But that hasn't translated into any kind of concrete policy. And I think that it might be avoidable for a short time longer, but I think like with anything, if we can plan in advance, we'll be a lot better off when the rate of population movement picks up, which I believe it will. And if we wait and don't take action, we'll eventually be forced into action and it'll be a more reactive and defensive posture. The goal is to make Americans as strong in the face of these challenges as possible. It doesn't require a lot of change in terms of adapting to climate migration and making communities more resilient. And, you know, it kind of points to some very idealized policy goals, but things like improving the availability of childcare and the affordability of childcare, because that's an affordability issue for a lot of American families that affects how much savings they have. And those savings translate to how much flexibility does a family have to evacuate from a disaster or to move in response to a slow moving change or to rebuild a home that's damaged. So that financial stability that depends on social policy directly translates to how flexible and how resilient, you know, an individual or a family is to adapt to climate-driven change. And so that becomes one of the most important, how do you support communities in the same way? I focus in the book quite a bit on the role of property insurance, on housing insurance, and the way that a lot of states across the country are guaranteeing the availability of inexpensive insurance to repair people's homes, even when they live in the path of destruction or face enormous climate risk. And this is a practice that arose out of the state of Florida after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Tens of thousands of structures were destroyed. The commercial insurance companies left the state of Florida. They canceled policies and said they wouldn't offer them anymore. And the state of Florida looked at their communities and saw the potential to lose population, saw the potential for an outflow of people and the collapse of its economy, and basically said, we can't have that happen. We're going to create a solution. And that solution is going to be to create a state-run insurance company. We'll promise that we can provide insurance to everybody who chooses to still live on the coast or in the path of future hurricanes. And we promise that we'll basically discount commercial prices by 20%. And it was hugely successful. Millions more people have moved to Florida. It's remained and always has been one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing state in the country. And a lot of the reason for that is because insurance was cheap when the risk was extremely high. And the insurance professionals that I talk to talk about how that's mismatched. They think of the world in terms of risk and the cost of that risk. And risk is a signal that tells us, you know, how vulnerable we are, how vulnerable our assets are, our savings, our retirement accounts, things like that. And the cost of insurance is supposed to reflect that. And maybe we assume that cost, but it is at least a communication tool to let us know how much danger we're in. And so when the state of Florida, you know, subsidizes that insurance and then discounts the cost of it, it's blinding its residents to the real hurricane risk that they face, to the real climate risk that they face. And this has been replicated across 30 states because Florida was so successful. Our entire identity in the United States is built around economic growth. Our definition of prosperity has to do with economic growth. And our political representation is dependent on economic growth or on growth in general, right? And if that population decreases, as it has in parts of California, you lose representation in Congress. All of these arrows point in one direction, and it's the wrong direction in terms of the context of climate change and, you know, potential migration from it. And so I don't have easy answers for how you fix that. It's a systemic problem and a huge challenge that is going to require a lot of smart minds. And some of the people that I talk to talk about, you know, breaking down silos between agencies of expertise, you know, better communication between the health department and the building departments or the transportation departments in individual communities. Others point to the need to break down divisions between levels of government. You know, we have federal, state, county, local systems, and they don't always coordinate. We have all these sort of barriers, and it would be nice if there was a more regionally and federally coordinated effort to address demographic change, or at least to guide it, create best practices, create funding mechanisms, and some guidance for projects that are needed. But we haven't seen that yet. I write in the book a bit about Los Angeles's efforts to plant, you know, 90,000 trees. And that's a classic example where in Los Angeles, historical inequities and redlining in particular have led to a lack of green space, you know, in minority and impoverished communities across the city. And so there are no trees, there are no parks in the poorest and Latino and Black parts of Los Angeles. And those communities now, with climate change and heat waves, are hotter than the communities that have trees and parks by 5 to 10 degrees. And that 5 to 10 degrees is oppressive and is literally killing people. There's higher mortality rates, higher rates of cardiac arrest and other associated diseases with extreme heat in those communities. That's a really clear example of how climate change is disproportionately affecting underprivileged communities, and a really clear example of the opportunity to change that in concrete ways. And as Los Angeles goes and plants 90,000 trees, they're doing it first, as they should, in the communities that have none more than the communities that have some. And that's a very small step to leveling just one little part of the playing field, but all those small steps can start to add up. So I'm really concerned about the dilution of truth, first and foremost. I have some concerns, but I think that they're kind of manageable about the automation. And so in terms of journalism, I think that means some degree of content creation is going to be automated. But, you know, I have some confidence that there's always going to be a role for providing that, so long as the integrity of truth is preserved. So back to my sort of first order concern, and that's where I think the biggest risk is. To me, this is, you know, it's very personal. But to me, our natural environment is everything. it's where I recreate, but it's more than just for sort of fun and entertainment. It's, you know, it's church. It's the most valuable and beautiful thing that we have, our natural surroundings. And for me, it's where I find peace and clarity and where I'm able to unload some of my own stresses or anxieties. It's where I, you know, creative inspiration and rejuvenation. For me, all of these things are always made possible in one kind of beautiful, natural, untouched environment or another. This is the life that we've got. And I feel great sadness for the things that I know that we've lost, but younger people don't have that perspective, which in this particular context is maybe a relief. And so all there is what's in front of them. And there is an ample supply of natural beauty in our natural environment and in the people around us. And I would just say, as we all settle into a less predictable future with all sorts of bumpy roads and roller coaster rides, that we also stay focused on experiencing what's in the moment, that beauty and that community.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.